Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The economic damage from the global financial crisis continues. In the U.S., numbers released today show retail sales in October dropped by the largest amount on record. In Brazil, the central bank is spending $50 billion to shore up the country's currency. Germany just announced an economic stimulus plan, and Britain is expected to outline one next week. All of this is the backdrop to the summit of G20 world leaders that's taking place in Washington this weekend. This meeting of the leaders of the world's 20 largest economies is being called Bretton Woods II. That's after the 1944 meeting, which created financial pillars like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Joining us to talk about this summit is Zanny Minton-Bedos. She's economics editor for The Economist magazine. And Zanny, we know this conference was originally proposed by French President Nicolas Sarkozy and British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. President Bush is hosting it, but who are the G20?
Well, as you say, it's basically not only the biggest rich economies, but also the big emerging economies. And that's a very big shift. Up until now, the main summit of global leaders has been the G7, the Rich Countries Club. And now we have this new grouping. It's not technically a new grouping. The G20 has actually existed for about a decade, but it's the first time the heads of government have met from these countries. And so it's quite a big shift. It's a recognition that we need a kind of new multilateralism, and that to sort out the world's problems now, you can't just have the rich countries in a group. You need the big emerging economies there too.
And what's the ultimate objective?
Well, if you listen to the rhetoric of the leaders before here, you'd think, as you said yourself, that they were going to remake the world. Bretton Woods II, they have this grand comparison of the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, which in economic terms is like the founding of the modern economic system. It's not going to do anything like that. That meeting came after several years of technical preparation. It lasted 3 weeks. It was during wartime. It was after the Great Depression. There was a real sense, led by America, that the world needed to be remade. We'd have nothing like that now. This was hastily called together in a few weeks, in very little preparation. It's not going to achieve anything grand like that. I think what the best it can do is two things. Firstly, we are still in the midst of this crisis. So before we start redesigning the world financial system, we need to take more steps to get out of the mess. And we, I think, may have seen, with luck, the worst of the financial panic. But we've now realized that the global economy has fallen, particularly the rich countries, into a very nasty recession. And so some commitments to more coordinated fiscal stimulus would be a very good step. A general recognition by these leaders that they all need to work together and they need to do more to not only stop this crisis getting worse, but to get the world economy out of it. Mm. I think that's the very much the first step. And the longer-term questions of what you do to try and make the system safer, that's going to take a long time. It's going to have to be done at the technical level. These are not issues of how to regulate financial markets. Can't be sorted out by presidents sitting across the table in 5 hours.
We do know, of course, also that many of these countries are coming with different agendas of how to make the system safer and of how to work in a more coordinated way. Many European leaders say it's oversight and regulation, and President Bush has been reluctant to embrace that idea. Does that seem to be the main theme, how to have more oversight and regulation to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Well, that's certainly what the Europeans want, and there are some differences within the Europeans, but broadly, that's their agenda. I think the worst outcome would be if we saw a lot of finger-pointing during and after this meeting. Then it would really be worse than not having it at all. I think the whole point of this would be to come together to some common understanding of the causes of what happened, and they're not simple. It's not just excessive deregulation. It's not just too cheap a credit. There are lots of different causes that came together to cause this perfect storm. And I think if we had a clear laying out of what that was, that would be a big step forward. But you're absolutely right. The risk is that each country is using this for its own domestic political purposes. So for the Europeans, it's very convenient to say that this shows cowboy-style capitalism is dangerous. If there's too much of that tone, then I think it really is worse than not having it at all.
Do we have indications right now that there's a lot of that underlying what might be happening here, that the U.S. is at fault and there will be a lot of finger-pointing at the United States?
I think there has has been a lot of that sense, but I actually think that now people realize the situation is sufficiently serious, sufficiently global, everybody is affected, that they need to come together and to work together to get us out of this.
Let's talk about some of the folks who helped organize this. French President Nicolas Sarkozy, what does he want out of this in terms of a specific proposal, do you think?
Well, I think first and foremost, this is him playing a central role on the international stage. So he's doing this a lot for his own domestic purposes. He has a conception of a more regulated financial market. He very much wants more order brought to global financial markets. In terms of concrete proposals, also Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, who again has seized upon this, wants to turn the IMF into a much bigger, more important, robust institution that can provide an early warning system. He also wants to have regulators from different countries work much more closely to oversee the world's biggest financial institutions. And that's actually a very sensible idea, because although we have an increasingly global capital market, regulation is done at the national level. And I think a more effective cooperation to oversee the world's biggest financial institutions would indeed be a very good step forward.
France has said that the Spanish banking industry might be a model for some other countries. Is that expected to be?
That's absolutely right. That's one of the ironies of not having Spain technically as part of this grouping, because Spain is a country whose financial regulation in many ways is a model for others, particularly because Spain had what are called counter-cyclical capital requirements. And that means that Spain had a mechanism which meant that its banks had to set aside more in good times so that they wouldn't have it countered the kind of natural tendency of banks to go from greed to fear, if you will.
What's China's role in all of this?
I think every country that comes to the table is going to want to show what it is doing. And China, as you know, earlier this week unveiled a very dramatic fiscal stimulus package. Possibly not quite as dramatic if you look at the fine print as they trumpet, but still huge, absolutely huge fiscal stimulus package. And that is very clearly designed not just to shore up domestic demand within China, but the timing of it is designed to show that China is stepping up to the plate, that it will do its bit to keep the global economy going. Right now, China is really one of the very, very few engines of growth. And if China's economy can prevent slowing, you know, much below 8%, then it will be a really central engine of the world economy next year. And for the Chinese to announce this package just a few days before they come to Washington is, in my view, no coincidence.
You know, I read one U.S. business analyst who said putting together new regulations during a fragile economic time like this is sort of like fire chiefs coming together during a five-alarm fire and trying to restructure the fire department. Would you say that this is sort of a first step and we shouldn't expect anything concrete from this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're still very much at the stage of needing to douse the fire. We've just got a broader, more representative and better team of firefighters coming together. So I would see this very much as a meeting in firefighting mode. Then I think they might lay out a few principles for how to reform the system more broadly, but that's a function not just of many more gatherings. It's a very technical process that will take years. It's not one that heads of state can do or should do.
And it will set the stage for another summit in 100 days, is that right?
They've already said they want to have another summit in 100 days, and that's, of course, because of the political reality in the U.S. I mean, having this kind of a summit with a lame-duck president and with a president-elect not participating, of course, dramatically weakens what it can actually achieve. So this is, at best, the beginning of a longer process.
Well, Zanny Minton-Bedos, economics editor for The Economist magazine, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Among the nations attending this weekend's summit is Brazil, which is the world's 10th largest economy and which has had enormous growth in recent years under President Luiz Lula da Silva, but not anymore. Auto sales are down, workers are being laid off, and credit is scarce. Over the last 6 months, the value of companies traded on Brazil's stock market plummeted by more than 60%, and the country's unemployment rate is 7%. However, that is down from 12% in 2002. Dr. Ana Teresa Albuquerque is the chief economist to Brazil's Minister of Planning, and she joins us on the line from Sao Paulo. Can you tell us more about how the economic crisis is affecting Brazil right now?
Yeah, the first thing that we observed in the first days of October is that our stock market suffered a downturn. We faced high outflows of foreign investments in the short-term securities in our and also in our company shares. But there was, we see a lot of mixed, still a lot of mixed information in Brazil, because our foreign direct investments, for instance, are still high.
So there's been a downturn. Would you say there's been a downturn? But it's not all bad. It's you're still sort of reading the tea leaves and figuring out exactly where you stand. Yes.
Yeah, we believe that only after November, when the figures of November are released, we will have a better picture of how deepness and how long this shortage of external credit lines will impact our activity.
Who is being affected by this shortage of credit and by the stock market downturn?
The sector that was more affected were the exporters and also agriculture sector because of the commodity prices and small and medium-sized companies. But there was no systemic we don't see systemic impact or systemic problem in our banking system, for instance. But because of the problems we are having with the exporters, the central bank created new credit lines, short-term credit lines for them, and so we expect this would be a temporary problem that we are facing now.
Your president, Luiz Lula da Silva, has said that for this weekend's summit in Washington that Brazil wants to have a major role in drawing up any new rules that might come out of this meeting regarding the global financial crisis. And he also said that rich nations that set up the current financial system failed to foresee or prevent the current crisis, essentially pointing the finger at the United States for what's happening with the global economic crisis. Does Brazil, do you think, blame the United States in large part for being the major cause of the global financial crisis?
This is a very tricky question, I guess.
It seems that other countries are certainly saying that.
No, it's just it's as a whole. You see, the deregulation somehow, the easing of liquidity for many years, contributed to our growth, to Brazilian growth.
So it's hard to criticize. It's hard to criticize something that's helped your country.
I think the main problem would be the regulation of markets which sell derivatives. I think it's a very specific problem.
What would you like to see then come out of the meeting in Washington this weekend? Would you like to see more regulation of things like hedge funds and derivatives? Do you think that that should be an ultimate goal of the leaders?
I believe it will be a natural decision. Even because the banks and the hedge funds and everyone will be more worried about their investments. It will be a natural consequence, I guess, of this turmoil.
Dr. Ana Teresa Albuquerque is Brazil's chief economist to the Minister of Planning. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Deborah.
Just ahead, it is that time of year for the often dreaded performance evaluation. Are they productive for employers or employees? One management consultant says neither. And later in the show, a new study shows devastating declines in the number of mammals around the world. We'll find out why. Back in a minute, here and now. Major U.S. employers are cutting jobs. Sun Microsystems will eliminate as many as 6,000 jobs, or 18% of its global workforce, because sales have collapsed. U.S. Steel will lay off 675 unionized workers, 2% of its staff, because of the lack of demand for its products. Given the increasingly dire news about the economy, you might be worried about your job and your performance review this year. Typically, in a performance review, a worker lists goals and accomplishments, as well as weaknesses and areas that need improvement. It's designed as a way to give supervisors and workers a chance to communicate about their work and often about a worker's salary. But our next guest says the performance review is, well, BS. Samuel Culbert is a consultant, professor of management at the UCLA Anderson School of Management, and he's author of the book Beyond BS, and you know what that means. And Sam, you recently wrote in the Wall Street Journal that performance reviews are little more than dysfunctional pretense that only serve a boss's authority, and you actually call them immoral, and you seem to have apparently touched a nerve here. You say you've gotten a lot of response?
I got over 400 emails in response to my article. And essentially, emails were saying, amen. I'd say 85% of them said, amen, brother. Thank you for pointing out what is so obvious, what I've been living with for years. How often does somebody get a performance review that has faults on it, get a new boss, and not have the same faults or any faults put on the next performance review? It's one person's reality. And darn it, the boss's job is not to sit back and evaluate. The boss should be the performer's absolute best teammate.
But, you know, I also looked online at some of those and some of the reaction to your article, and some folks said, you know what, you're off the mark. The performance review has helped at work. Or, as someone else pointed out, you know, performance reviews aren't necessarily the standard for review or for the workplace right now.
I think that's a very good point. On the blog, one of the people made a wonderful statement for me. It was very clarifying. That manager wrote in and said, I've been appraising other people and conducting performance reviews for 25 years, and I've trained people to do them very well. Then he said, but you know what? 2 months ago, my boss called me into a meeting and ambushed me. He decided to give me a performance review. And in that review, he redefined my job, and he used some metrics that had no meaning or made no sense to me. And since that time, I've been demoralized in my job, and I've been faking it with my boss. I've been faking it. In other words, his boss doesn't know his negative reaction. And then I thought, my God, this guy has to connect the dots. Why would he presume that if his boss doesn't know what the impact of that performance review was on him, why would he know what the impact of all the performance reviews he conducted had on the people that he reviewed? He wouldn't know.
How do you get to the point, then, that you feel that you do have a more effective way of communicating between the performer and the supervisor?
Well, the kind of conversations you need to have are ones of two human beings working for one another's effectiveness. Now, in order for you to help me be effective the way I can be most effective, you really need to know a lot about me. You need to find out about me. You need to ask questions. And instead of saying, I wouldn't do it that way, I would do it this way, and the way that you would recommend obviously is going to be the way that you know how to do it. Now you say, hey, it wouldn't occur to me to go about it that way. Tell me more. Tell me, why are you going about it that way, and what can I learn about you from the fact that that's how you're going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a boss and subordinate having conversations as necessary about how you can give me more help and how I can give you a little bit more guidance. And if I give it to you, and you're still not performing effectively the way I'm going to tell you that I would like, then I find out we're not a good matchup. Now we have a question. The most essential and most important management effectiveness tool the company has, the best tool a company has, is straight talk between the boss and the subordinate. It's not about good guys and bad guys. It's about your guys and what you need to do to make your guys the good guys.
So what happens if two people really don't have the chemistry, the ability, whatever you want to call it, to be able to get to a point where they can have that kind of straight talk in their relationship?
That's right. That's right. The company suffers every time. People tell the boss what the boss wants to hear, and they go out and do something else.
You know, but I guess, isn't there a difference in personal relationships and, say, institutional relationships? Sounds to me like we do need some level of BS at work.
Well, I think BS is just, like that old advertisement about the American Express card. you don't want to leave home without it. Maybe 98% of the times of people's interactions at work are where you cannot be above board and straight in talking with another person, with revealing your motivation, with telling them what projects you have in mind, you know, going to a meeting where that you know nothing's going to get accomplished. That's BS. You don't want to go there and somebody says, well, are you going to the meeting? Of course I am.
But especially in this economy, you're not going to say, you know what, no, I'm not. We never do anything in those meetings.
That's right. On the other hand, you owe it to yourself because of the value of straight talk to find people and to make relationships where you can talk straight as often as possible with as many people, because when you're talking straight with people, they're looking out for you, and they're giving you such wonderful information that you need, that you might, and perspective that you might not be able to pick up for yourself. And when you could have a straight-talking relationship, you also find out what the other, candidly, what the other guy cannot deliver, and you find out why, and then you have a chance to fill in the gaps for yourself, rather than to stand back and fault that person for not doing what she or what you believe she or he should have as number one priority.
Hmm. All right. Well, Samuel Culbert, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Still ahead, from ABBA to ZZ Top, NPR music critic Tom Moon's list of songs to hear before you die. Back after the news, here and now. A major global survey of the world's wild mammal population has a sobering conclusion. It says at least a quarter of mammal species are at risk of extinction. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, published the study. It found devastating declines in both land and marine mammals. Jan Skipper is the union's Global Mammals Assessment Director and head writer of the study. And Jan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
What are some of the species where we see the biggest threat of extinction?
The species which are increasingly becoming the most threatened are the larger ones, because they usually need a larger area, and they tend to have smaller populations globally. And one of those groups are the marine mammals. 36% of all marine mammals are threatened, as opposed to 25% of all terrestrial mammals. So proportionally higher in the marine realm, which could partially be due to some of the historical context of whaling, but currently also due to accidental mortality and pollution.
When you say marine mammal, are you just talking about whales, or are you talking about other species?
No, we're talking about whales, seals, dolphins, sea lions, in some cases sea minks, any mammal in this case which spends a high proportion of its life in the ocean, near shore rivers, and even in lakes and streams.
And let's take a look at some of the particular problems for different species in different areas of the world. I read in the report Vietnam and Cambodia have a particular problem. Can you explain?
Sure. Well, primates are getting hammered in Southeast Asia, where you have this medicinal market being driven by China. You have a traditional bushmeat trade in these areas, and then habitat loss, especially of forests, which primates seem to get the raw end of the stick any way you look at it. They're losing forested habitats, which they absolutely require, and then they're just big enough that they make a sizable meal for somebody. So in places like Cambodia and Vietnam and all over Southeast Asia, we're seeing declines by as much as 70-80%, especially in primates, but also in any larger-bodied mammal in that area.
Hmm. So specifically, what species there?
Well, there's a lot of different primates that are being affected. The gibbons are one particular example. Because they have a very distinct call, people tend to be able to locate them in forests and access them through various means of hunting as well.
But in China, I thought that I also read that there was actually, in terms of gibbons anyway, a little progress.
There is. With the Hainan gibbon, specifically, there were approximately 29 individuals left in that entire species. So it's easy for us to monitor progress when we're talking about an increase in 4 or 5 individuals. Mm-hmm. Actually means a huge proportion of the population is recovering. But, I mean, we still need to realize that there's less than 100 individuals of that entire species left.
How about Africa?
Well, Africa has similar problems. In Central Africa, for example, the deforestation and the bushmeat trade is really driving the loss of species. However, there is progress also in certain parts of Central Africa in establishing national parks and protected areas, which in the end will be one of the main solutions that we need to look at for protecting species.
And how about North America?
Well, North America has a long history of conservation efforts. One of the key species that we've seen begin to recover is the black-footed ferret, which became a sort of a highlight of our launch of this project, because in 1996, the species was declared extinct in the wild, whereas today it's actually declared endangered. So it's gone in just over 10 years from extinct in the wild, jumped over critically endangered altogether, and now is in an endangered category, which actually seems like it's still in bad shape, but it's a lot better than it used to be.
And what about other species that we may have to watch out for in North America?
Well, there's a couple that are of interest. The polar bear has attracted a lot of attention recently because of climate change, and depending on how you look at climate change models and which ones you accept, the polar bear is going to decline probably in any number of scenarios. Any loss of sea ice, for example, will fragment the populations and ultimately reduce their areas for hunting and pupping. And this is also true for some of the seals, harp seals, for example. There are other species which we've just begun to be able to evaluate. This would be the bison. There's actually surprisingly few left in what we would call a natural state. Very few bison left, and this was a surprise to us because it's something we hadn't actually considered to be possibly threatened, and it didn't get on the list of threatened species, but it's very close to being on that right now.
You know, when we say that a particular species faces extinction, that also affects other species, isn't that right? I mean, the interconnectedness of the entire system is affected, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And a lot of these systems are connected in sort of cascades where we don't actually understand the cascades until we start to see species fall out of them. And then we begin to see sort of the snowball effect of other species having, you know, other species falling out. So sort of a classic example of that are rodents, which are seed predators and seed dispersers, and primates also, which disperse seeds. When you remove those pieces of the system from a forest, then the trees no longer have a way to disperse themselves. And over, say, 100 years, your whole forest composition could turn over.
You know, I remember reading a Harvard biologist estimate that half of all present plant and animal species would be extinct by 2100. Do you think that that's accurate?
Well, I think what happens between now and 2100 is entirely dependent on the way that we begin to live our lives as the planet begins to fill up with people. If we continue as we are now, I think that's probably true and very true for mammals. We're seeing a decline now. I mean, even though 25% are considered threatened, 50% of all mammals are declining to a point where in the next 10 years there could be a lot more species on the endangered species list or the list of threatened species from IUCN.
And that's because of basically human habits and what we're doing to the environment.
Right. So with the IUCN threat categories and criteria, those are almost entirely driven by humans. We didn't really, I mean, there are a lot of natural events that threaten species too, but what we measure are actually habitat loss, over-harvesting, and the things that we can quantifiably get from just seeing what humans are doing around the planet.
Aside from the black-footed ferret in North America and the gibbons maybe off the coast of Southeast China, was there any other good news in this report that you found that a species was improving?
Well, of all, so I did mention that 50% of the species are declining, but the flip side of that is that 5% are increasing, and the difference there are ones that aren't increasing or decreasing that are stable. So of the 5% that are increasing, of which the black-footed ferret is one, I think we're actually learning how to do species recovery, and it's something that we've been working on in North America for a long time using tools like the Endangered Species Act. The extent to which is usable is very politically driven, so it's not the ideal system. So the IUCN Red List attempts to remove itself from the political end and list species scientifically, hoping then, of course, that governments and non-government agencies and planners will be able to use this information.
And that 5% recovery, those species are recovering, and that's a direct result of conservation efforts.
They are recovering as a direct result of conservation efforts, and there's a lot of them are the huge mega charismatic species that a lot of people have been thinking about for a long time, the African elephants, the pandas, the oryx, the black-footed ferrets. But the species that we've really seen go extinct the quickest are the ones that occur on islands, the ones that occurred probably before we really knew what was going on. You know, when Columbus was exploring the New World and goats and cats and rats were escaping onto Caribbean islands, there were rodents going extinct, and I think now we're much more able to monitor the species that might go extinct next and actually begin to do something about it.
Jan Skipper is Global Mammals Assessment Director for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN. Jan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
In this heads up on a story we'll be looking at soon, $1 trillion apiece. That's the estimated cost to build and maintain an F-35 fighter jet over the course of its lifetime. One defense analyst asked if we're spending too much and getting too little. You're listening to Here and Now. This, of course, is the Beatles' hit A Hard Day's Night, a song that would likely make it onto many a music lover's list of all-time favorites. Our next guest spent many a day and night compiling his list of music that he says we should make sure we take the time to hear. NPR music critic Tom Moon's new book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life List. And yes, A Hard Day's Night is in there. In fact, there's a lot of music here. In many cases, one item on the list is an entire album. So this is a pretty hefty book. And Tom Moon joins us to give us a sampling. Welcome.
Hi.
It was a lot to page through. I imagine it must have been an awful lot to listen to. Did you listen to all of these again?
Oh, yeah. And many more besides in culling the list. You know, someone says, go find us 1,000 recordings. You think, oh, well, I'll just pick my favorites. That'll be easy. That's how I started and very quickly realized that even if my taste was, say, to be good enough to actually come with that kind of a list, it would be somewhat narrower than what you'd want for a beginning listener or someone just beginning an exploration of music. The first thing I did was go back to records that I was pretty sure would make most reasonable people's list of great works, sort of the world culture greatest hits kind of records.
The harmonica's play, the skeleton keys and the rain. And these visions of Johanna are now all that remain.
Bob Dylan, Blonde on Blonde, the Beatles records, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, things that are just sort of in that top shelf category.
So then how do you then narrow it all down? These are the ones, your sort of standards anyway, in your collection. Then how do you, A, narrow that list down and then figure out how to expand it so it's diverse and including things that, and it's not necessarily that you didn't remember them. Maybe you never even heard them before.
That's right. And there's a lot of that in the book. There's a lot of music that I didn't know about that I discovered in the course of sort of journeying. And obviously any book that's going to attempt to address jazz, opera, blues, music from Brazil and Africa and a bunch of other places is not going to have a set criteria. There's no way to say all this music has to do A, B, and C. What I looked for instead was the sense of a peak experience, of some sort of quintessence, something that you couldn't get from almost anything else. And even in listening to Beethoven, there are some recordings of Beethoven where it's just such a singular experience. You're so galvanized by it that it makes it feel like living music.
What music did you discover in this journey that surprised you, that you hadn't heard before, that you had to include in this list because of the peak experience that it represented for you?
The most extreme example I can think of is Celtic music. I was never well-versed in it. I didn't like it. I was never a bagpipe fan or anything like that. I made the mistake of confessing that to my editor, and she said, well, you're not going to ignore this music now, are you? So I actually had to double back and do much more research about Celtic music than I maybe would have had I not opened my big mouth. But it ended up being great because, first of all, I learned that not all of it is the kind of like shrill and or very exceedingly sad or exceedingly happy music that we associate with Celtic music, but actually that there's a lot of stuff in the middle that's beautiful and poignant and relies on the same kind of ensemble interplay that great jazz does. You know, when I heard the early Chieftains records, which I listened to bits of about three or four of them before I ended up with the one that's just called Four, I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is just fascinating ensemble play, and everybody's really, you can tell that they're in it. There's the feeling of life is on the line here a little bit.
This is, of course, The Chieftains. We'll be back with more of Tom Moon's Life Music List after a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. We're speaking with NPR music critic Tom Moon about his book, 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. His list runs from ABBA to Beethoven to Eminem to Radiohead to ZZ Top. In fact, the book lists just about every possible musical genre and some that defy classification. And Tom Moon, in putting this book together, you went back and you say you rediscovered a lot of music you thought you knew. Was there something that you said, oh, I'll definitely put that on the list? And then you listened to it and you said, you know, maybe not.
There were a lot of those.
Yeah.
The most famous one, the one that I'm getting the most flack for, is Dave Brubeck, who, you know, has that record with Time, I think it's called Time Out, that has Take Five. Take Five was a huge jukebox hit. The rest of the record is considered to be, jazz critics all put it in the, you know, sort of Hall of Fame category. And I listened to it and I was like, you know, the writing is really great. I love Brubeck's idea of composition. But as a piano player and as an accompanist particularly, he's sort of throwing a lot of elbows. There's like a lot of right angles and things don't settle. And here's Paul Desmond, his accompanist. And I really love what Desmond does. Let me go listen to some Desmond records. So when I started, I thought for sure that I'd have Dave Brubeck in the book, and I ended up with a Paul Desmond record called Take 10, which is 3 years after Take 5. It's totally a remake. But this time, Desmond is playing with the great guitarist Jim Hall, and everything's relaxed. And Jim Hall is just totally sort of under the radar accompanying Desmond, and you really get Desmond's sound, and it's just such a much more effortless record. And it's like, this is the way to experience this kind of jazz. It's through Desmond, I thought.
The list is so diverse. We should mention, aside from some of the things that you've talked about already, I mean, Janis Joplin is on this list. The Pearl album, yes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Had to have that one.
Had to have it. You know, and she's another one who she's in with both feet. You feel all of her heart and soul and her life experience when you hear her sing. And you don't have to know her backstory. You don't have to know her associations. You don't have to know who she played with. You hear that voice and the conviction she's bringing. It's galvanizing.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. That's all that Bobby left me.
And at the same time, you have, for heavy metal fans, you have the Pantera CD, Vulgar Display of Power.
Yeah.
And it is vulgar. And when you describe it, you cite the Ovid quote, a safe pleasure is a tame pleasure.
Right. Well, which it is. And when you hear this record, it's so in your face. And there's so much energy behind it that it, even if you don't like heavy metal, you just really, there's something about it where you just, you have to tip your hat and say, you know what? These guys are totally about this.
Full of grief, I screamed out the wind. Thought I heard the words of others.
Let's just talk for 1 second about starting with ABBA and the disc Gold. Have you got a lot of grief for that?
I think that if my music critic brethren knew that I liked ABBA even a little bit, they'd take away my card and I wouldn't be able to practice music criticism anymore. But these guys were craftsmen and women on a high level. And this was music that, even if it's very light, is so well done, and there's such accomplishment in it, you don't even have to love it to respect it.
I'm wondering if you've already heard from people who have said to you, I can't believe you put this in, you should have done this one, or, you know, even within a particular artist, maybe. Have you already gotten a lot of feedback like that?
Yeah, I sure have. Some of my friends who know my taste have called me out on things. As I said, I couldn't make this a list of my favorites, and a good example, or one example for me, is Pink Floyd. I knew that I was going to have to contend with Dark Side of the Moon some way. But my favorite Pink Floyd record is the one that came after that. It's called Wish You Were Here. And yet, when I went back to Dark Side of the Moon, I was like, you know what? This record is a huge landmark for a reason. And I'm doing that new explorer a disservice if I don't address this record. End of each entry, there's a little paragraph that talks about other albums in the artist catalog that are worth hearing. And so in the case of Pink Floyd, I write a little bit about Wish You Were Here in the entry about Dark Side of the Moon, and then knew that I could at least mention Wish You Were Here in that appended paragraph.
Hmm. And you could only list 1,000 here, but almost immediately after your list, you have 108 more recordings that you should know about. You just couldn't narrow it down.
Well, and even worse than that, that list was actually about 330, and we only had one page in which to put anything appended. So we were stuck with only 108, but it was heartbreaking even to call that list, because these are all incredible works.
Well, we should mention that when we were speaking with you earlier, you actually did request a song. So you did request one. Can you explain what your request is and why?
Since the book has been finished, I've spent a lot of time going back through and sort of checking my head and going, all right, did I really miss stuff on certain artists? And I cannot stop listening to this vocalist named Elis Regina, who was big star in Brazil in the 70s. She's sort of after Bossa Nova. As a singer, I think she is on that very rarefied plane with Frank Sinatra and Marvin Gaye and a few other people, where every little phrase of hers is just perfect. There's no effort in it. There's no artifice. There's no contrivance. And you don't have to understand Portuguese to be completely moved by her.
Hoje foi que a perdi, mas onde já nem sei, me levo para o mar.
Tom Moon's new book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life List. Tom Moon, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Great to be with you.
Meu corpo sem lugar. Rios me lavei,
mansidão um dia ancorar e ao vento me esquecer.